You've heard me say it before, and now I'll say it again. One of the best things about my association with Montpelier, James Madison's historic home, and specifically the Center for the Constitution there, is that from time to time when I'm out there, I just run into some of the most fascinating people one could ever hope to have dinner with. And one of those people that certainly qualifies in that category is Ralph Ketchum. Ralph Ketchum is a professor emeritus of history, public affairs, and political science at Syracuse University, where he has spent more than six decades. And the particular reason I was interested in speaking to Ralph, and I've been hearing about him for years, was because among his many other accomplishments, he has written the definitive single-volume biography of James Madison. He wrote it all the way back in 1971, and to this day, it is still respected and cited by everybody who's anybody in the James Madison field of study. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about the mind of a Madison scholar.
This is your Weekly Constitutional, underwritten by James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
I was recently out at Montpelier, staying in the Constitutional Village. I think I was speaking at some sort of event. My memory fades because whatever else I did on that particular trip to Montpelier just fades in comparison to the serendipitous encounter I had right there in the Constitutional Village when I ran into a fellow whose picture was very familiar and whose name, of course, was very familiar to me, Ralph Ketchum. He's a professor up at Syracuse, or he was. He's now a professor emeritus. And he is famous in Madisonian circles for having written the definitive single-volume biography of James Madison. And then having returned years later, 30, 40 years later, and written more recently about both of the Madisons in a book called The Madisons at Montpelier, Reflections on the Founding Couple. This is a guy who both began and not quite ended, but has come close to ending his academic career focused on James Madison and Dolly Madison. He is the guy. And so, of course, I sat down with him. My wife, Priscilla, was with me. We sat down with him and with another friend, and he started talking, and I stopped him. And I said, Ralph, this is fantastic, but let me go get my microphone. And today I'm going to share with you that fascinating, fascinating interview with Ralph Ketchum.
Well, I taught at Syracuse University now for 62 years, and I've always...
Wait a minute. You taught for 62 years?
Right. That's partly because I did my doctoral work at Syracuse University, and I was a TA when I started doing the doctoral work. So I taught for 5 years before I got my degree as a kind of TA.
62 years you taught. That is absolutely astonishing.
Yeah, I started teaching in the fall of 1951.
Wow.
When, as I say, Harry Truman was president, Stalin was still alive, and the Dodgers were still in Brooklyn.
Well said, sir. Well said. And was your entire career up at Syracuse?
More or less, although I've always had a faculty appointment there.
Uh-huh.
But I've taught in other places for, I don't know, 10 or 15 years of that time just by being away.
Sure.
And in fact, being away started, I started doing a dissertation. My advisor was somebody who had recently gotten interested in the founding period of the United States. And he knew he was interested in ideas, and I was too. And he said, well, which person you ought to look at is James Madison, because he's not been enough attended to by historians, and there's a lot of mismatch out there about him.
This was back in the 50s?
Yeah, okay. I started in 1952 and finished it in 1956.
Finished what in 1956?
My doctoral dissertation,
right.
The title of which was The Mind of James Madison.
Well, that's very straightforward.
And that's right. Started writing out on, and in that, in the course of hunting around, then I wasn't married and a carefree graduate student, and I came to Montpelier once when Mrs. Scott was still running the horses here.
That was Mrs. DuPont Scott, right?
Yeah, Marion DuPont Scott, and it was at that time clearly a working horse ranch, and there were racetracks around everywhere. And I talked for a long time with her estate manager, a man named Chester Hazard, who gave me a wonderful sense of what farming was like in Virginia. Mrs. Scott kindly came down and said hello to me and welcomed me. But it was nothing like the mansion is now.
Right, it used to be pink stucco, wasn't it, at that time?
It was pink stucco on the outside. And her main sitting room, I always describe it, it looked more like a lounge that you'd find at Pimlico or near some other racetrack.
Right.
Because all her pictures of horses were around there, and there was zebra striping on the lounges.
That was the Red Room, right?
So that's the Red Room. It's now sort of reproduced in the DuPont Gallery over in the Visitor Center.
That is absolutely remarkable. So back in the 1950s, you sensed, or your mentor suggested, that maybe James Madison had been overlooked, or maybe we need to do some more. So you did The Mind of James Madison as your doctoral dissertation.
Right, yeah.
What a cool title.
Yeah.
Now, we're here today because, of course, you're an emeritus member of the board of Montpelier. Okay, and I wanted to get to that to explain to people why we're talking. We're here today at Montpelier together. But I don't want to leave this early period in your career quite yet. I find it absolutely remarkable that you did this, because I've often been fascinated as to how Madison came up with his ideas. And perhaps because we share an alma mater, I was a graduate of Princeton and he was there when it was the College of New Jersey. I've often wondered, and forgive my ignorance, did you go into his formative years at Princeton under the tutelage of Witherspoon, and what authors he might have read while he was there, and how they affected him?
Well, I did indeed. And in fact, I went to Princeton while I was working on the dissertation. I've been back since. I had also been in touch with Irving Brandt, who was in the process of writing the basic 6-volume biography of Madison's life. It still is. Everybody that deals with Madison has to start with those 6 volumes.
Isn't it remarkable to say the basic biography and it's 6 volumes?
Yeah. He was an interesting person himself. He had a study that Justice William O. Douglas gave him access to in the 6th floor of the Library of Congress. He was an old newspaper man, a progressive from Missouri, and he somehow had the resources to just stay in that study, and he was there for 20 years or more writing 6 volumes.
Wow.
And he was a kind man, environmental fanatic before there were such things. He took me on a hike one time up the Chesapeake Canal. We hiked along for a while, and he was with his wife, who was Irving Brandt was one of these tough, wiry individuals, and used to hiking 20 or 30 miles easily. And after we hiked a long time, we stopped, and we had a snack. And the snack consisted of strips of cucumber. We lay down and both used as a kind of, put them on our forehead to kind of cool ourselves. And then we ate the snack was cucumber strips and carrots.
And after hiking 10 or 15 or 20 miles.
That was his idea of a snack. Yeah. Well, anyway, I got interested more in Madison through him. And in Princeton, I talked to the archivist, and he said, there are in the archives here some notebooks, sort of commonplace books, from Madison's era when Witherspoon had first come to Princeton. And the way they taught those things at that time, Witherspoon gave lectures, and the students wrote it down. And then when they came to class the next day, they had to say them back, and just a kind of recitation system. And he said, we've got the notebooks of 2 or 3 students, and they turned out to be students in the year 1772 and 1774, which is just after Madison had left Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
And these were Witherspoon's lectures in moral philosophy, which included political theory and public affairs and morals and everything. And it was the president's, almost always given by the president to all the students in the senior class, who weren't usually maybe 20 or 30 altogether, small colleges. And this was the president's chance to sort of give the students the moral foundation and the grounds of how they ought to approach their life. Anyway, these notes are all there, and I looked at them, and in Witherspoon's notes that this student had recorded, Witherspoon said that there are three kinds of government: government by the one, or by the few, or by the many. And there were in each of these categories good and bad examples. Where am I headed? That's the beginning of Aristotle's Politics, and mm-hmm. Witherspoon was just paraphrasing it.
Right.
And this is where Madison got his basic idea of what government is all about. People still turn to politics, to Aristotle's Politics, to do that. If you took political philosophy, you probably did that. Mm-hmm. And this was right away contrary to the superficial conventional wisdom that Madison was in the age of the Enlightenment, and that his political thinking would have been based on someone like John Locke. And in political ideology, there's a lot of difference between the two. And so I was puzzled. I thought, well, if Madison started out from his respected teacher with straight Aristotle, that must be where Madison's political thinking comes from. And that started me on a kind of somewhat eccentric path of thinking about Madison, because there were a couple of other Irving Brandt's books didn't say too much about his political philosophy. Irving Brandt was a newspaper man who had been covering politics, and he was intensely interested in Madison's political career in Congress and as Secretary of State and in the diplomacy and then running the war. And he didn't particularly groove on Madison's political thought. And the other biographies, the old biographies, weren't any good at all. A lot of them were unable to get over the fact that Madison was a slave owner and had been on the wrong side of the...
Hey, it's an important fact, but it's not the whole story.
That's right. That's right. So what I was led toward, and it leads easily to the Constitution and much of the rest of Madison's career, is that he believed as Aristotle did. Aristotle's pet phrase always is, man is a political animal. What he meant by that was that politics is part of human life, and that man, to be fully developed as a human being, needs to take part politically in the community that surrounds him. And that's why he was favored government by the many. And this goes on to the next thing Aristotle said, was that the purpose of the state is not for life merely, but for the good life. That this political orientation of human nature was led him toward concern for and attention to and a usefulness to taking part in government that would then be active in doing things to make the country more beautiful, more prosperous. That's what the Athenian Oath says. And so I always had a different view of Madison from those who, I think, superficially had paid attention to his arguments in Federalist Papers and some other places that lead toward emphasizing the limitations on government. But I was pretty sure that was not the whole story, and indeed not even the basic story, because for Madison, government was not only there to protect the people from other predators and even from the government itself. The government had to be limited, but it also had to be active in pursuit of the good life, and the essential citizenship that Madison defended and always promoted in the country was toward this responsible, deliberative, active citizenship to support a government and a union that could move toward a good and prosperous life for the country. And that's always been my understanding of Madison.
After, to promote the general welfare, to coin a phrase.
Exactly. Yeah, and to do the whole thing.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a perfectly wonderful interview today with Professor Ralph Ketchum, Professor Emeritus of Syracuse University, who is probably the preeminent biographer of James Madison anywhere in the world. This is a good one. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll continue our in-depth discussion with Ralph Ketchum. So don't touch that dial. Once again, it's time for our constitutional quiz, and I was expecting the quiz guy, but today he's all dressed in his fancy green skin-tight leotard. It's all green with a green mask. Could it be
the Riddler?
I see. Well, what kind of riddle do you have for us today, Doug?
Hey, today we've got a great riddle.
A great riddle.
Here we go. I'm an island to myself with a strong statehood streak. I skipped the debate and had no representing signature. I was so late to ratify, the president was already picked. Who am I?
I guess Hawaii would be too easy and obvious an answer, but I don't know.
Well, I'm going to give you four choices.
And did I just blow one of those choices?
Choice A is Hawaii.
Well, maybe that's the right one.
Hint to listeners, it's not Hawaii.
Well, okay, I'm sorry. I blew it for you. What are the other ones?
B, Manhattan.
Manhattan. Well, that's an island.
C, Rhode Island.
Rhode Island.
It's even got island in the name.
Yes.
Or D, Ellis Island.
Ellis. Oh, that's a very important island as well. Let's see what our contestant has to say. Well, contestant, could you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Tim Lindstrom.
Tim Lindstrom. And where are you from, Tim?
I hail from Johnson City, Tennessee.
You're sounding awfully familiar to me. Why is that? Have we met somewhere before?
This might be my second time on the program here, trying to seek out a bit of redemption for my previous appearance.
Now I remember you were just on the show a few weeks back, and you took a quiz, and it just didn't work out. What was that question you asked before, or you were asked?
I believe it was whether the President of the United States could be an ordained priest or minister.
That's right, and you got tripped up, if I may say so, because the idea was that you thought maybe that was too much religion and state mixing together, right?
That is accurate, absolutely.
Right, and that was actually, it was a hard question, because it does sound strange to have the idea of a priest or a minister as president, or a rabbi, perhaps, but when we really thought it through, we realized that they are citizens just like anyone else, and they have free exercise rights. And by golly, if they want to run for president and we want to elect them, it's perfectly okay. But you felt bad about not winning.
Absolutely. Felt the need for redemption.
Now, is this a matter of pride, or is there some girl out there you really want to impress with your T-shirt?
Well, I am very happily married and have been for a number of years, so this is all about the pride.
It's all about the... Well, you can still want to impress your wife.
You make a very good point. We may need to edit that last part out. I hope she's not listening.
All righty, then. If I recall correctly, there were four answer choices. They were A, Hawaii, B, Manhattan, C, Rhode Island, and D, Ellis Island, even though I screwed up and kind of helped you out by eliminating answer choice A. Do you have any idea among the other ones?
Well, I'm going to have to keep my fingers crossed here and go with Rhode Island.
Now, why would you pick, that's answer choice C, why wouldn't you pick B, Manhattan, or D, Ellis Island?
Well, I believe that the question was about ratification, and if I am correct, Rhode Island is the only answer there that is actually a state.
Wait a minute, Manhattan's not a state?
To my knowledge, no. I believe Manhattan is part of the great city of New York.
I think they think of themselves as being their own nation, let alone state, but I think... Perhaps in a strictly legal sense, you may be right. So because Rhode Island is the only answer choice remaining after I blew Hawaii, the only one remaining after that is actually a state, and therefore the only one that could have ratified, you think that's the answer. You're going to stick with that as your final answer?
I am going to do that. Rhode Island is it.
So, Doug, what is the answer?
Well, you know, it's got to be an island.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that it's got to be a state. You know, I'm an island to myself with a strong statehood streak.
Well, that's why I was thinking Hawaii.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
So, you know, Manhattan isn't going to make it. Ellis Island isn't going to make it. It's Rhode Island, of course.
Rhode Island.
You know, they skipped the debate. They never actually sent anyone to the Constitutional Convention.
Well, actually, I did know that because I happen to recall that they used to call Rhode Island Rogue Island.
Nice, nice, nice.
And indeed, because they didn't ratify, I think it was what, till like 1792 or something like
that?
They
didn't ratify the U.S. Constitution until after Washington was president.
Right, exactly. And the funny thing about all of that is that when we had the bicentennial of the Constitution, either the mayor of Philadelphia or maybe it was the governor of Pennsylvania invited all of the other ratifying governors from the original 13 states to come to Philadelphia and talk about that. Rhode Island refused. And they said, we're not coming now. We'll come in a few years on the 200th anniversary of when we ratified. So they are still rogues.
You know, it's amazing. I'm expecting to see a bumper sticker that says, Rhode Island, the oh shucks, I guess we'll join you state.
Well, Tim, congratulations. You won this time.
I could not be happier.
Tremendous. No doubt you and your wife, who will now be very impressed with her learned and erudite husband.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again, Doug. That was a very good riddle.
Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm having a perfectly fascinating discussion with Ralph Ketchum, Professor Emeritus of Syracuse University and author of The Preeminent, one-volume biography of James Madison. Now, before the break, he was telling us a lot about Madison's political thought and about his basic focus. Turns out it had to do very generally with the general welfare of the United States.
The preamble of the Constitution perfectly states Madison's idea of the purpose of government. It's true, it doesn't have legal force like the rest of the document, but it states the...
I'm not sure of that. I'm not sure of that. I mean, you know, the court has said that from time to time, but you know, it's part of the Constitution. There it is.
It is, but it doesn't confer any power on anything.
Yeah, I know, but it's supposed to guide us now, isn't it?
It is, but there you're right in the rubbery.
It's pretty rubbery. You're right. Please go on.
And that's... But your point is still, I think, entirely proper because it should clue us in to how to understand the powers that are conferred in the Constitution. They're conferred to do all those things like promote the general welfare, domestic tranquility. And,
yeah, why are we doing this?
Right, exactly. Right. And it's because Madison started out with Aristotle. He knew that.
So Madison was not an Enlightenment guy as much as he was an Aristotelian.
Right.
Yeah. That is remarkable. But before we go on anymore, Ralph, I have to interrupt you here and say you've just ruined my day. Because as an academic myself, I'm always looking for that next scholarly project. And I came up with this really great idea. I thought to myself, I'm going to write an article, and it's going to be called Madison at Princeton. And I'm going to go back, and I'm going to look through the archives, and I'm going to see what he did there and what his influences were. And you did this 60, 70 years ago.
60 years
You've
ago.
You've done it already. And I'm really just ashamed that I haven't read your dissertation, and I'm just ashamed that you've already done this, and I didn't even know that.
But I haven't done it definitively. You could go to Princeton and get those same notebooks out. And also, you know, Witherspoon's writings were eventually published in 6 or 8 volumes.
Right.
And those are available. But actually, you look at those volumes and they're different in a lot of ways than the notes that Madison or these people who were there at the same time as Madison copied down. So he wasn't teaching the same thing that eventually ends up in his books.
So you think there's some more work to be done?
Yeah, I think so.
I was thinking actually of tracing it back to the Scottish Enlightenment, mm-hmm. and trying to figure out where Witherspoon got his ideas.
Right.
And that would be a wonderful way to convince my dean to send me to Scotland for a sabbatical.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so I can still do that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to quote you on that.
That's great. And there's still something to be learned there because that's exactly what Witherspoon intended and accomplished. He brought the Scottish Enlightenment to Princeton. We know the books that he brought. There's a list of them in the library somewhere. And it's all the standard Scottish Enlightenment stuff that you'd expect to be there. There's Adam Smith, and there's David Hume, and there's Ferguson and Hutcheson, and all the names are there. Those books were there when Madison was there. If he hadn't read them before, which he probably hadn't, he had a chance to read them at Princeton. And I think the Scottish philosophy is, well, it's a variety of the Enlightenment, but it's the variety that Madison paid most attention to.
Right.
Later we know, for example, when he left Princeton, and remember that he stayed a few months just to study more with Witherspoon.
Princeton claims that he was their first graduate student.
Well, that's informally true. There wasn't any degree involved or anything, but mm-hmm. but he did stay after he graduated to study more with Witherspoon. And he talked about that experience and extended it in his correspondence with his closest friend at Princeton, William Bradford, and that's published. Right. We know that. And that's a wonderful account of how these young men were making use of what they had learned and were extending it. Madison's writing Bradford, whose family ran a bookshop and newspaper in Philadelphia, and he said, how about these books? And send these to me. So we know where he was going from his studies at Princeton.
Right. And Philadelphia was the city at that point.
The city.
In the United States. Was Bradford the fellow to whom Madison wrote those letters decrying the establishment of an official religion in Virginia?
That's the Bradford.
That's the same guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a wonderful correspondence. And has actually only been revealed in recent years. I say recent, the last 50 or 75 years, because we knew before somebody in Bradford's family had saved the letters that Madison wrote to Bradford, or some of them. Mm-hmm. And they're wonderful letters and have a lot of the basic stuff in them. And they were found in the late 1880s in some heir of Bradford's family. But only much more recently has Bradford's letter book been discovered. I don't know if you got where it was, somewhere in the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. And Bradford recorded not only Madison's letters to him, but his letters to Madison, so much, much fuller. And Irving Brandt had gotten hold of that, and he told me about it. And they're all now published in the papers of James Madison, so that's a matter of record. But when I was working on it, it was new. I was interested in the same thing that you were. How did he furnish his mind, and where did his ideas come from? And I think he was a tried and true intellectual whose ideas came from the books that he studied. Mm-hmm. A lot of people try to make it more complicated than that, but
he was a bookish fellow.
That's right. Yeah, he's as bad as Jefferson. They just love
it. I agree. But you know, there's also a thesis I have that I want to prove at one time, and I want to check it out with you now. My thesis is this: that the best constitutional scholars are short guys.
I hadn't thought of that, but
you're a very tall fellow.
Yeah.
So you're going to resist this, aren't you?
I guess so. I'm thinking about it. of course, even in Madison's day, John Adams was short. Madison was short. Jefferson was tall.
Yeah, he was tall, but he wasn't there. He wasn't at the Constitutional Convention, so I'm not even going to give
him any...
He
wasn't there, but in person, but, you know, he and Madison were exchanging letters at the time, and
right.
And he was there in terms of his ideas, I think, and I think in terms he loved the Constitution. A couple of things he didn't like, but basically he liked it, and I think it's not possible to distinguish the two in any fundamental way. I would say almost ever. There's a great book about it by Adrian Koch called The Great Collaboration, Jefferson and Madison.
Right.
And it came out in the early 1950s, and it was wonderful because it came out just when I was looking at it. And it's a marvelous book because it shows exactly how their minds worked. It is true that Jefferson was the one who had the more high-flying ideas. He set out like he wrote the famous letter, "The Earth Belongs to the Living Present."
Right.
And went on to write about how that should apply. And he sent that to Madison. Madison writes back, as he always does. He said, "I love the idea you've got here, and the idea that past generations shouldn't govern future ones, that ruins the idea of self-government. So, but," he said, "you got to think about it. Is that all there is to it? Is it not true that generations not only shouldn't control the future, but they also should acknowledge their debt from the past, and how does that affect what they ought to do in the future?" And in other words, he's saying, "Jefferson, it's too simple the way you've got it out. You got to think about it a little more complicated. I like the idea, but be a little more sensible." Henry Clay said that Jefferson had more genius and more brilliance. Madison was more profound and had better judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they always interacted. And it often, over and over again, Madison would call Jefferson to account on what he called his two rounded expressions. And he just, and
you're painting with a broad brush, Tom. You got to bring this down to earth.
That's right. And of course, it's present in their prose. Jefferson had no trouble at all being eloquent. And Madison very seldom achieved it. His writings is often convoluted and sort of backs around into things. It's good judgment and solid criticism and profound, but it doesn't ring like Jefferson.
You know, isn't that funny, Ralph? We're going off a little bit. This is cool. This is a really interesting idea because there is a difference between analysis, or if you will, profundity,
mm-hmm.
on the one hand, and expression on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that perhaps Madison, or at least the authors you're citing, are saying Madison was the more profound, but Jefferson simply expressed himself better. He was the more eloquent, and perhaps that accounts in some degree for why we revere Jefferson to such a greater degree as a nation than we do Madison.
Well, I think that's true, and Jefferson, he was eloquent, but his eloquence was also very serious.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it wasn't just... They always used to contrast that kind of eloquence with Patrick Henry. They neither of them could stand Patrick Henry because he was a windbag that didn't work hard. But he was... But Jefferson was had to take those flights of fancy and had the rhetorical excesses. But that's Madison almost never took what Jefferson said down by refuting it. He always wanted to modulate it and make it a little bit more precise and sort of logically defensible.
So great ideas, Tom, but how exactly are we going to put this into practice?
Exactly
are we going to get something done in this regard? But I want to go back to you. I mean, you in the 1950s, you write this thesis, The Mind of Madison. Because Madison has been overlooked in the literature up to that point, or perhaps misinterpreted.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Ralph Ketchum, the preeminent biographer of James Madison, whom I ran into at Montpelier not too long ago. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Ralph Ketchum. Stick around.
Octagon House, also known as the Colonel John Taylor III House, is located at 1799 New York Avenue Northwest in the Foggy Bottom neighborhood of Washington, D.C. It was designed by William Thornton, the first architect of the United States Capitol, and built between 1799 and 1801 in Washington, D.C. Colonel John Taylor III, for whom the house was built, owned Mount Airy Plantation, located approximately 100 miles south of Washington, D.C., in Richmond County, Virginia. In 1814, Colonel Taylor offered the use of his home to President James Madison and his wife, Dolly, for a temporary executive mansion after the burning of the White House by the British. Madison, who used the circular room above the entrance as a study, signed the ratification papers for the Treaty of Ghent there, which ended the War of 1812. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And now let's finish our discussion with James Madison's biographer, Ralph Ketchum. Ralph was telling me before the break that he came to the study of James Madison early when he wrote his dissertation on what he considered to be an overlooked and underappreciated founder.
So after your dissertation, The Mind of Madison was published. What did you do?
Well, it's a doctoral dissertation that wasn't published.
Oh, excuse me. After you were finished with it and you got your PhD, congratulations. Yeah. That was from Syracuse, right? Yeah. So you're a Syracuse guy, like, through and through.
That's right.
Okay, so you get your dissertation done, you get your PhD, so what happens next?
Well, one of my professors at Syracuse was a professor named T.V. Smith, who had been at the University of Chicago for 25 years before he came to Syracuse. He was very famous. And one of his colleagues there was a political scientist, public administrator named Leonard White, who had founded the discipline of public administration. And he decided that he wanted, for his sort of semi-retirement project, to edit one of the founding fathers. Julian Boyd had already started with Jefferson, and Hamilton was taken, but Madison seemed to be available. And he was a wonderful organizer, and he got financial support, got the University of Virginia to cooperate, Chicago Press, and so on. But he needed some young people to do the legwork. And his friend T.V. Smith said, well, I've just got a graduate student who's just finished it. So I went to see Leonard White. Leonard White hired me, and I worked for the Madison Papers for 3 or 4 years as editor.
Did you overlap with Chuck Hobson?
He was a little later.
Okay, good. Chuck and I spoke some time ago.
In fact, he didn't come aboard much, I don't think, until the Madison Project moved to Virginia.
Oh, okay, fine.
When Bob Rutland,
so you were before Chuck, and you were there from the inception.
I was from the absolute beginning, yeah.
And then when you say edit him, you mean basically collect as many writings of Madison as you can, from published writings to private letters to everything else, and figure out what they mean and put them in context and publish them.
Yeah, when we started out the project, we had the same basic philosophy as Julian Boyd. We wanted every letter that Madison ever wrote, as well as every letter that was written to him. So the first job was to find them. And I spent 2 years going all over the country hunting for Madison letters. And
that sounds really cool. So how does one hunt for a Madison letter? I mean, you must have some basis for going to a certain place or area.
Oh, that's right. Well, you go to some place like the Massachusetts Historical Society, for example. And they have some Madison papers in their files, and we're glad to have them. And so I arranged to have them copied and sent back. But then I asked the librarian, who knows all about old families and papers and stuff in that area, where can I might I find some Madison papers? Well, just their knowledge of the people around, and they told me, well, there's a lawyer in Boston named Charles Story, whose father was an eminent international lawyer and went to Versailles with Wilson. But he's descended from the family of Dolly Madison's sister, who the Madisons are very close to.
Right.
And that he had some Madison papers, he thought. Well, I said, I'll go see Mr. Story. And I went to his law office, and he said, yeah, there is a a trunk in the storeroom that's got some old Madison papers in it, he thought. He was interested in his father's papers, not Madison. But he went there, and the first thing that was in that document was a commonplace book of James Madison's.
And that's remarkable. Now tell me what a commonplace book is. I know what it is.
A commonplace book is what a student in those days had as he did his reading and studying, and he did two things. He took sentences here and there that he thought were especially, same thing we were doing, we're taking notes. This
right.
And also, he probably would paraphrase some things that the author had said. And the first item in this commonplace book had the title Mont chiefly. Well, I thought, well, this is probably Montesquieu. It's not. It's Montaigne.
Oh, really?
And so, as editors, we had to identify where Madison got that from Montaigne. And it's easy to do once you start it, because you know the bibliography of Montaigne. This was a three-volume, and it's the first document in the Madison papers. And we found it in the trunk.
How old was he when he made this commonplace book?
Well, there was a date on the corner of it, 1759.
That's early.
Yeah, he was only 8 years old.
I
think probably there it was about a 15 or 20 page thing, not completely filled in sort of heavier covers. Somebody must have given it to him, and my guess is it was given to him in 1759. And he put the date there, but he didn't get around to using it much.
Yeah.
And we can tell both from the stuff that he refers to and the way he handles the readings and so on, that it's probably from his Princeton days.
That's remarkable. I don't think he'd be reading Montaigne as an 8-year-old.
That's right, sure.
Yeah, I mean, he's a smart guy, but I mean, come on.
And that's right. And the other's similarly true. There was stuff from the Spectator papers, but it was of the polite literature of the Augustan age rather than the hard political stuff like we think of Locke and Hobbes and so on, mm-hmm. Which was another window to me on the nature of his mind, that it wasn't the sort of curriculum that you would have in graduate school today in a political philosophy course. His mind was attentive to sort of the livelier currents, studies of literature and philosophy and history and polite literature and essays. And that's what formed his mind. And he remembered that. He wrote a nephew late in, when he was old, he wrote a young nephew that the things that he should do to improve his writing was to read the Spectator papers of Joseph Addison.
Huh.
And read the writings of Dean Swift, Jonathan Swift.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's telling that kid these were the writings that I remember and that I looked at and took seriously. Again, a kind of shift away from the standard hard political stuff. And once you get that, see that, and look at how Madison handles books and commentaries and various kinds, that's where his mind is. He's reflecting the polite literature and philosophy and outlook of the Augustan age, and once I understood that, I understood more about his philosophy of government.
Now, just for the benefit of everyone who's listening in, when you say Augustan age, what are you referring to?
It's the literature of the post-Puritan period in England, beginning sort of with Dryden in the late 17th century, and goes up, flowers great with Alexander Pope and the Spectator papers and Jonathan Swift, who commanded the literary and intellectual life of England sort of in the first quarter of the 18th century.
Okay.
And it's the time when John Locke is coming in, but John Locke comes in along with a lot of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it, for one thing, it pays more attention to the religious and moral and philosophic life and writings than we're inclined to remember. but I'm pretty sure Madison's head was formed there, and it's what helps us understand how his ideas develop later on.
Right. So you only spent a relatively short time editing the Madison papers.
Yes, they're 3 or 4 years, yeah.
But then you went on and you wrote a number of books about Madison, or yep. about the Madisons, yep. plural.
Yep. That's right. And this was... I went back to Syracuse for a year and a half, and then I was one of the editors of the Franklin papers for a couple of years.
Oh, really?
Which was a wonderful experience. I wrote a little book about Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... When you're editor of their papers, you live with them in detail, 8 hours, 12 hours a day, because what you have is the corpus of their writings, facsimiles of the original documents in front of you, and you have to make sense out of them. And in doing that, you get a sense of intimacy with them that you cannot get, even when all you can look at are the printed versions. So I think...
Because you're seeing a lot of these in their own handwriting.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, Ralph, this is all absolutely fascinating, and I could stay here for hours, days, weeks, learning from you at the feet of the master. But I guess I'm going to have to try to bring this up to the present day. We've talked a lot about how you became a Madison scholar. We've talked about your attempts. In fact, your very successful attempts to get inside what you call the mind of Madison. Do you have any grand conclusions that you've reached in your career? Can you sum up what you have learned in your career and what your studies have brought you to?
Madison's whole career was to give reality to that conception, a place where there would be equality, liberty, justice, and a form of government that would institutionalize that is the Union. And that's what Lincoln understood. And
that's why they cared so much about the Union.
Yeah.
See, now that's something that periodically through my life I've questioned. You know, why didn't Lincoln just let the South go?
Yeah.
If they really want to go, if there's some argument of self-determination or simply of political necessity, let them go their own way. What's this obsession with the Union? But it is something he shared with Madison, and yes. It's because they felt that the Union was the vehicle through which they would achieve these great goals.
That's right.
The American experiment.
The ideals.
It was worth preserving.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Martin Luther King always said that the United States didn't learn to have new ideals. It just had to live up to the ones it already had.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Madison and Lincoln had already declared. And it's why they fought the Civil War. You know, Horace Greeley said, just as you said, let the Erring Sisters go. If they want to have slaves, get them out of here. We don't like them. But Lincoln said, it's the power of the Union that has institutionalized ideals of justice and freedom that has to be stay there so that eventually we'll get rid of slavery. And when Lincoln said that and knew that he meant it, that's why the South seceded. They knew that Lincoln was going to, well, the first issue was keep it out of the territories. And the South knew that if that was institutionalized, that slavery would gradually diminish in the country and would die. That's why they said, we're going to go to war to stop that.
Mm-hmm.
And Madison was right with him. He lived long enough to come out against nullification,
right,
and secession as well.
That was 1832, 1833,
that's
and he
right.
died in 36, right?
That's right.
So he got to see all of that, and Andrew Jackson and all of that.
Yeah, and actually, through Madison not only published letters, public letters that were spread all around the country opposing nullification, but Jefferson's grandson-in-law, Nicholas Trist, the married one of Jefferson's granddaughters, was a private secretary to Jackson at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Madison funneled stuff to Trist, who then turned it over to Jackson. And it's that kind of thinking that results in Jackson's famous force bill, where he says South Carolina, they aren't going to get away with it.
Right, South Carolina is saying we're going to nullify federal laws with regard to collection of duties and things of that sort. And Jackson basically says, if you try to nullify our laws, we're simply going to come down there and make you obey.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to enforce the law.
Right.
And we aren't going to. And that was a theory that Madison, he said he had articulated something like that in the Federalist Papers.
Right.
And this was in his public letters, made the same point in 1830-31. And there was this interesting backdoor to Jackson himself.
So in a word, Madison was, first and last, a Union man.
Mm-hmm. Lincoln's Union.
So a straight line from Madison to Lincoln. Well, thank you so much of research into the mind of Madison.
Glad to do it, Stuart and Jordan.
He was a small, shy man from Virginia. Ended up writing most of the Constitution. Wrote the Federalist Papers to convince the rest. We need this Constitution. It's for the best. He was later Jefferson's Secretary of State. Wrote his coattails to President in 1808. He wanted small government and no central bank. But with the War of 1812, he needed that bank. When Britain was a bully, he pushed for this war. But many debated it on the House floor. Both sides lost the war. The White House burned down. That's okay, the country's now truly independent. He constantly defended his Constitution when a growing number of people seemed to attack it. But everybody seemed to love his wife Dolly. They even loved him after kicking butt in the war. Yes, the pragmatist, he changed his mind on some things, like a central bank and less taxes on industries. After he left office, he still fought for states' rights. He was the last founding father to survive.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Ralph Ketchum, and thanks to the good folks at Montpelier for bringing us together. I'm looking forward to my next serendipitous encounter in the Constitutional Village. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Madison Minute is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock. My name is Stuart Harrison. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment. Next time on your weekly Constitutional, a perfectly fascinating discussion with Ralph Ketchum, who is the definitive biographer of our fourth president, James Madison.